Okay, we can get started. Next speaker is Joe Polchinski. His title is Lessons from Field Theory, String Theory Duality.
Well, I'm going to be covering a lot of the same ground as Gary, but I think from a fairly different point of view, so hopefully this will generate a different set of questions, or maybe the same questions over again. Field theory, string theory duality here refers to the ADS-CFT duality, which Gary talked about. But to put this in context, I want to talk about first the fact that our understanding of what string theory is has undergone really two radical revisions in the last few years to bring us to the point where we are today. So there was the first age, which was the age of perturbative string theory. Then there was the age of string duality. And now we're in the age of Maldacena. So the first will be short. Up until a few years ago, any talk that you might have heard about string theory would begin something like this. In fact, it probably would go on something like this for an hour. Namely, it would talk about string theory being defined, well, first of all, in terms of one-dimensional objects, these loops here, and then amplitudes, transition amplitudes, being defined by summing over all world sheets, all ways to get from here to here. And this theory in particular has in its long-distance physics gravity and other fields. Now, I'm not going to dwell on this because this is, again, this is the way we used to think about it. And everything that we used to know, everything that would fill a 900-page book is... is still true, but what has changed is how we interpret it in terms of the larger picture. Now, I should mention, though, since this is a talk about strong gravitational fields, that even in this early age when understanding was very incomplete, we learned some interesting things about how string theory modifies space-time geometry at very short distances. Certainly, the understanding wasn't complete, but some interesting things were learned. The main tool was this thing called conformal field theory, two-dimensional conformal field theory. When you are summing over all string world sheets, well, that's a two-dimensional surface, and so you're basically doing two-dimensional quantum field theory, and for the various stringy reasons, it's conformal and so on. There are lots of tools. And the two of the more interesting geometric things that were learned were that string theory resolves certain singularities, that you can take strings propagating in a space, which is a vacuum solution, it's Ricci flat, but it has a singularity, and string theory gives a complete and non-singular description of the physics in that space. The singularities are not the most interesting singularities, they're not cosmological singularities, they're not Schwarzschild singularities, they're generally time-like singularities, which are more or less conic. Not so conic that they have, you know, zero curvature, but just in a general sense are conic. And by the way, this is a very interesting subject because, generally speaking, there is stuff happening at the singularity, namely there'll be extra degrees of freedom that live there, and a lot of the interest in the subject comes from understanding the relation between the geometry of singularity and the degrees of freedom singularity. And related to this, another thing that was learned about string geometry was that in some cases one could give a controlled description of topology change. That is, one could follow a space-time moving slowly, more or less adiabatically, from one. This is schematic, but you know, from one topology through a topology which would be singular regarded as a classical geometry, but again, which is non-singular. In string theory, and then emerging smoothly into a geometry of different topology. So even in this first era, there were things learned which about geometry were very interesting. Again, no complete picture, but things which show that strings see geometry and topology and even dimensionality in a different way from the kinds of point particles that we're used to. Now, the second age is summarized by this picture that I like to draw, although this time I've added color to it. Because what I want to emphasize by the color is how the first age and the second age are related. So what is this picture? Well, this picture shows a two-dimensional slice through the Hilbert space of string theory. Okay, Hilbert space of string theory is huge, so this is a slice through it. But it's a special slice because these are all vacuum states. They're all stationary states, translationally invariant in some directions. Equivalently, you can think of this as representing some two-parameter space of classical solutions which have the form of some dimension of Minkowski space product with some compact space. And from that point of view, the two parameters are parameters that characterize the geometry of the compact space, sizes and angles and things. Okay, and these really are equivalent in the sense that any one of these geometries is the starting point for a vacuum state. You quantize around that. So these are two ways to think about the same picture. And what I've shown in red, I've highlighted just these boundaries. And what's special about those boundaries of this parameter space is that only there is a is string theory useful. Put differently, that string perturbation theory that I drew, that sum over world sheets, in some sense generates an asymptotic expansion as you approach these limits. Now, in the first age, we knew of these five different string theories, which all of them happen to appear on that picture. And the interesting thing is that you consider a two-dimensional slice with the string Hilbert space, and there, in that one single Hilbert space, there are different limits any one of the five different string theories is the description that generates the asymptotic expansion. So the first age is kind of thinly wrapped on the part of the boundary of this Hilbert space, and now we have the whole interior that we have to understand. And let me save this one because I like it so much. Away from these limits where we do have a complete asymptotic expansion, we have no complete description. There's this one point which I won't dwell on, but I'll mention because it was one of the great surprises of this subject, that there's a point in the Hilbert space where the space-time symmetry becomes larger than we knew of in string theory. Or put differently, there's a point in this Hilbert space where the geometry becomes the geometry of 11 flat space-time dimensions, whereas in string theory, always the largest string theories live in 10 dimensions. Their space-time symmetry group is SO91. But in this larger Hilbert space, there's a point of larger dimensionality and larger symmetry. Now, how was this picture mapped out? Well, the basic tools. Again, there is no complete description here in the interior. We know a great deal about its symmetries. And the other very important tool is that we can follow a small amount of the spectrum. I'm talking here about states that have some supersymmetry. And when you have some supersymmetry, there are some special states that live in special small representations of the supersymmetry algebra. And the nice thing about those is that their properties are determined entirely by the symmetry. So you can start somewhere over here and calculate the spectrum of these small representations. And now as you vary the parameters, you can follow those states reliably. And what you find, again, is that in certain limits, they become recognizably the spectrum of one of the other string theories or of an 11-dimensional theory or whatever. This is very schematic because it's just a two-dimensional slice through a much higher dimensional space. The higher dimensional space has phase transitions, and it has cusps that touch onto other surfaces and so on. Well, I'm sorry, that the Hilbert space, I guess, is a linear space. The space of vacuum states is a more interesting space. It has interesting shape. But the thing to emphasize here is that this is, in some sense, an experimental subject because we don't, again, have any complete description here in the middle. We are piecing together this position, this picture from the partial information that I discussed, and it's very pretty and satisfying how it works. You start from here and follow what you can follow, and you end up here and vice versa. The whole picture is very reliable, and again, it's very surprising how these five things are all limits in a single larger space. But what's lacking is any complete description, any complete theory of the physics in the interior here. I think one of the things, coming back to, there was a question, are D-brains made of strings? And let me first repeat something Gary said, which is that you can start with a string state over here, and as you follow it, very often it becomes over here a D-brain state. So the description string D-brain soliton is not something which is globally well defined on this space. And that's also maybe a clue that strings are not as fundamental as we thought. And in fact, one of the things that is widely believed about this is that although we call it string theory or various other things, it's not in fact a theory of strings. That this whole story of the quantization of one-dimensional objects that we talked about in this first age really, again, is the physics of the asymptotics. And there's no that series is not convergent. It's badly not convergent. It diverges more rapidly than in quantum field theory. And there's every indication that we're looking for some kind of new degree of freedom, some kind of new degree of freedom which has the property that, again, in certain limits, it organizes itself into something that looks like strings and these other structures. So we need a theory. We're looking for something new. History has shown that possibly some of the ingredients are out there and their importance not recognized. And so it's important to be open to the fact that maybe the idea that we need already lives in the mathematics of twisters or non-commutative geometry or in canonical general relativity. But I have to then append a warning that we're looking for a very specific idea, an idea which contains in and respects all the structure that we already have, and in particular, string theory is more than the sum of its parts. So if you go and look at, for example, the way that string theory resolves a space-time singularity, or the way that string theory describes a topology change, or there are places in this diagram where the compact manifold is smaller than the Planck scale, and you would say that gravity is then non-perturbative, yet string theory knows how to describe the physics. If you look at how string theory resolves these various singularities, it really is not something that in any sense lives in the gravity sector alone. It's really something that depends on the complete structure of string theory. All the fields, all the symmetries, all the extended objects, and I think there is some kind of unique whole here that we need a principle to describe. I mean it in the technical sense. Yes, I do. Well, the question was, when I said that string theory is an asymptotic description, do I mean that in the technical sense? So string theory is a sum over Riemann surfaces, and the more handles you have, the more powers of G, so it's a series. And what kind of series is it? Well, again, asymptotic would mean that, well, we all know what it means. It means that it really only describes the approach to this line and not any finite distance away. Now, that's really true in field theory as well. In field theory, the series is only asymptotic, but we believe that there is some formal machinery, quantum field theory, which in some sense sums the series, which gives us the unique, or more or less unique, maybe at parameters, completion of that series. And it was assumed initially in string theory that the same would be true, that you had this series and there was some string field theory, some formal completion, and then that would give you everything. And if that were true, then maybe one could, maybe there are several string field theories, all of which can be transformed into one another. There's no sign that that's true. The indications, again, go the other way, that string field theory in some sense would be the wrong enumeration of states, that the Hilbert space of this theory is just not simply, say, the Fock space of strings plus interactions. Okay, so that, I guess, was the second age. Now, the recent development is that we now have an answer to that question. That is, we do have what seems to be a complete description of the physics, a complete description of the dynamics of the theory, but not globally. Not globally, rather at special points in the Hilbert space, or not even so much points in the Hilbert space, but sort of at special disconnected parts of the Hilbert space. And what's special about these disconnected parts of the Hilbert space is that they are identified as having space-time geometries with certain special behavior at infinity, certain special boundary conditions. So, for example, for some, again, well, in some sense disconnected because the boundary conditions are discretely different from any of the boundary conditions I was envisioning here. For some parts of the Hilbert space of this theory, we now have what we believe is a complete quantum description. For example, all states of the one of the string theories, the 2B string theory, which have the property that their geometry is asymptotic to ADS5 cross S5, and also that which have some number of units of one of the fluxes of the string theory, that all states in this Hilbert space are that Hilbert space is identical to something old and in some sense boring. Well, the Hilbert space of a gauge theory, a non-abelian Yang-Mills theory with a large number of supersymmetries, specifically 16 supersymmetries, and where the rank of the gauge group, SUN, correlates with the number of units of flux over on this side. So SYM is always this theory, supersymmetric Yang-Mills. And so what I want to talk about for the rest of my time is why we believe this remarkable claim and how in somewhat more detail does it work. I'm sorry? So there's the question is, do I just mean near the 2B? And the answer is that I said I was talking in some sense about an island, a separate island in the Hilbert space. And again, what makes it different is its boundary conditions. And this island is just has a 2B description. Although actually, to be honest, I could surely embed this in a larger picture, where instead of ADS5 cross S5, one compactifies partially. So even here I'm sort of studying it's a very complicated space, as I said. So even here I'm studying some submanifold. Maybe it could be something which again has M theory and type 2A descriptions, could be attained as a limit in here. But I'm focusing on sort of just a piece that has a 2B description. Okay, so why do we do this? How does it work? Okay, so Gary gave the key ingredient in how this was discovered, which was it grew out of studies of black hole entropy in string theory. So we have these two things, these very stringy D3 brains, these fundamental membraney sorts of things with strings stuck to them. And then over here we have my rendition of a black 3 brain, which is something which is 3 extended times a some kind of black geometry. And the idea is that you can go in either direction, but I like to think about going this way. Namely, this is a black object, but as you reduce the coupling constant, there becomes a point where gravity is too weak to bind the system any longer, and it can no longer be a black object. It has to resolve itself into some kind of weakly coupled objects. And in this case, it's the geometry and the charge identifies those weakly coupled objects as being these D-brains. And also N, the number of D-brains over here, is correlated with the charge of the black 3 brain. And turning it around, you take these, you turn up the gravitational force, and again, Ted proposed maybe they become some kind of star, but I think one could exclude that. They become some kind of black object. Okay, and you can count, as Gary discussed, the supersymmetric states on this side and see that it agrees with the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy on this side. But then, also as he discussed, after that was done, various other things that didn't seem so supersymmetric, like decay and scattering amplitudes, were calculated, which also seemed to agree on the two sides. And this was crystallized by Maldacena into a duality, a new duality. And the idea is that you take the low energy limit in each picture. Well, over here you have something kind of field theoretic and three-dimensional, and all that survives is the massless sector, which is this 3 plus 1 dimensional Yang-Mills theory I was talking about. Over here you take the low energy limit, and this is my very poor rendition of a near horizon geometry. But again, the idea is that in this geometry there's a large number of low energy states, sort of an anomalously large number of low energy states, coming from the infinite redshift at the horizon. And so over here, these low energy states survive in the near horizon geometry. Over here, you have the gauge theory. And in some sense, the Maldacena conjecture is that the following two things commute, that making the three brains black and then taking the low energy limit gets you to the same point as reducing to the gauge theory and then increasing the coupling, so that this corner here, which is strings moving in the near horizon geometry, strings moving in the ADS5 cross S5 geometry, is what you get in the gauge theory at strong coupling. Okay, I'll talk more about whether that's a believable conjecture as I go on, but let me say a bit more about it. Well, there's the statement. That one way to say it is that commutation of limits implies that there's this identity. And this is a duality. It's a duality. What is a duality? A duality means that you have two seemingly different physical systems, which in fact are the same. If there is some one-to-one map of the Hilbert spaces, every state over here has a state over here, and so on. Hamiltonian is the same, and so on. So this is a duality, and it's a surprising one. Well, it's initially surprising, although as you look at it, it fits very nicely with things that have been anticipated. But it's a duality where, unlike this duality where sort of everything is stringy and kind of unknown, it's a duality where on one side you have a quantum field theory, the super Yang-Mills, and the other side you have this thing that you didn't previously have any definition for, any non-perturbative definition for, And now this duality in some sense defines it. It defines it, but that's not the only definition, because we have a lot of definition that's already, we have the asymptotic expansion of this at weak coupling that I was talking about. We know a great deal about this. So this is not a tautology. This is not a tautology. There's a great deal we know about this without having a complete definition, but now we have, in addition, what seems like a non-perturbative characterization. I'll come back to this later, but there's some constants in the problem. There's the string coupling, again, the charge, number of D3 brains, the string length scale, and the size of the ADS space. And it's worth pointing out that this duality has one of the important features of any duality, which is that there are different regions of parameter space where one description or the other is simple. So in particular, when this parameter GN is really what controls the perturbation theory of the gauge theory. The gauge theory is strongly coupled not just when G is large, but when GN is large because of the many degrees of freedom. So when GN is large, you have no way to calculate in the gauge theory. Perturbation theory in the gauge theory isn't good. However, when GN is large, the ADS space is very large compared to the string scale, and so we can use just ordinary field theory. And so, in this regime where the ADS scale is much larger than the string scale, it's on this side, the string theory side, that we can calculate a lot of things, and that gives information about the gauge theory in a regime where you can't calculate. And I'll come back to that later on. Okay, but now, why do we believe this, again, radical conjecture? Well, first I said it sort of comes out if you just make this innocent-sounding assumption about commutation of limits. Is that really a reasonable thing to assume? Is that really a reasonable thing to assume? This isn't calculus we're doing. It's a rather abstract thing. And could we think of some way that could fail? Well, yeah, in some sense it could fail if, as you increase the coupling, remember, the energy increases vertically and coupling increases to the right. It could fail if, as you increase the coupling, at some intermediate point you get a lot of new states coming down to very, very low energy. Then, in some sense, the gauge theory description of this point would not be the complete one. And that's, just as a first statement, that kind of thing is implausible. Namely, experience with other cases shows that generally states don't become light unless there's a reason for them to. That's the idea of naturalness. That states become very light, essentially, they have to become essentially massless to invalidate this. States become massless only if there's a symmetry reason for them to become massless, and there's no such reason here. That same kind of assumption, more or less, is made in mapping out many of these dualities over here, namely that there aren't anomalous states that aren't governed by the symmetries, which in fact are lighter than the states that one knows about. So it's in fact it's a reasonable kind of assumption that passes in other contexts many, many cross-checks and gives reasonable conclusions, and the same is true here. And here are some of the cross-checks and reasonable conclusions. First of all, the symmetries are the same on both sides. So on the ADS cross S5 side, you simply have these isometries, SO42 cross SO6. On the field theory side, the SO6 comes about as an internal symmetry, and the SO42 is the Poincaré symmetry enlarged by conformal symmetry, because this is a conformally invariant quantum field theory, a field theory which is invariant, in which the physics is invariant under changes of length scale and also under special conformal transformations. So the symmetries match up. Also, in fact, you might wonder, a field theory seems like it's a lot smaller than a string theory. Moreover, a field theory in four dimensions seems a very much smaller than a field theory in four space-time dimensions seems very much smaller even than just gravity by itself in 10 dimensions. So it's a satisfying check that in fact, you can identify all states of the gravitational field. Namely, if you consider sort of if you take the ground state, which is ADS5 cross S5, and consider a one graviton excitation, then that can be identified on grounds of symmetry and on grounds of energy levels with some specific state involving some number of the gauge bosons and some number of the scalars of the gauge theory. And similarly, in a color singlet state. And similarly, the multigraviton states can be identified with just product states like this. Okay, that's, of course, a particle physicist's way of thinking about gravity, enumerating the states by counting one graviton, two graviton, three gravitons. That, of course, doesn't make any of you happy. but it does show that, in fact, the degrees of freedom, I mean, that may not be the basis in which you want to describe these degrees of freedom, but it does show that those degrees of freedom are there. And part of the ability to make this correspondence is the fact that on both sides, the states are in small representations of the supersymmetry, so that you can reliably identify this state at weak coupling and then follow it to strong coupling. There's a question which always comes up in this subject: what is the precise role of supersymmetry? Is supersymmetry just a crutch that you use to solve these theories, and you would draw all the same pictures and say all the same things for a non-supersymmetric theory if you were smart enough to do it? And I don't know. I vacillate on this. It certainly is true that supersymmetry plays some role, because at some level, this does not work if you simply throw the supersymmetry away. If you try to take this duality and you take the attitude that I'm going to understand the bosons first and supersymmetry is an add-on, so you're going to take this duality and throw away the fermions, maybe you throw away the scalars, just do the gauge bosons, there is no corresponding non-supersymmetric duality. In fact, you don't get, you very definitely do not get the states of the gravitational field. And that's because the non-supersymmetric theory, the quantum fluctuations generate a mass gap. So there aren't these low-energy states, which are protected by supersymmetry and which play this role in duality. This does seem to be a common theme in much of the things that we understand, namely that supersymmetry is the mechanism that enables us, that makes it possible even for space-time to exist. Supersymmetry is the mechanism that quenches quantum fluctuations that otherwise would lead to no classical space-time picture. Again, maybe this is a limit of our understanding. Maybe there is some there are some special non-supersymmetric theories for which this goes through. But here's a nice example where you can see rather visually that if you just try to take the point of view, I'm going to save supersymmetry for the last thing. You can't understand what's happening. Well, there's supersymmetry on both sides because the string theory has supersymmetry. And in fact, I should have called this group SU22 bar. This is a smaller piece of a supergroup. But if I throw away supersymmetry on this side, on the gauge side, I don't get gravity on the other side.
But yes. It doesn't work. That is what you're referring to.
That's what I'm referring to. Right. That's what I'm referring to. And oh, by the way, again, the fact just in brief, one, the way that this 3+1-dimensional theory can simulate this 9+1-dimensional theory has to do also with the fact that n over here is very large. We'll come back to that. In fact, it's one of the key questions. It has to do with n. The size of these matrices over here is very large. So there's a lot more hiding over here than over here. And also you might think, well, no matter how large n is, it can't be the dimension. But really these dimensions are effectively compact because one of them is sphere, and the ADS is a space which you know has some properties of compact spaces. So in fact, a large matrix can equal some number of dimensions, and does. Also, various interactions, which again are protected by supersymmetry and so can be calculated on both sides, agree. And that, in fact, was the genesis of this again, this fact that things were agreeing that didn't seem to have to. But in some ways, more impressive than the things which agree exactly. And the things which agree exactly, you might say, well, that's just supersymmetry. More impressive is that things which aren't governed by supersymmetry, but which work qualitatively. So in particular, this duality, although it's very different from anything Atuft would have said in the mid-70s, dovetails very, very nicely with the conjectures that Atuft made about the behavior of large n gauge theories and their connection to string theory. And part of what he said, the connection between electric flux tubes and strings is embedded in this duality. Also, the thermodynamics makes sense. After Sean asked his question in the first talk, I scribbled a line here at the bottom, no proof. And there is, of course, no proof. It's interesting to think about what it would mean to have a proof, but I'll save that. Sorry? But Tuft's conjectures were non-supersymmetric and they were not precise. As we understand things now, the precise conjectures are supersymmetric. In fact, you can sort of by breaking, once you have supersymmetry in some sense, once you have supersymmetry in the underlying theory, you can break it at lower energies and get to non-supersymmetric conjectures, but they are complicated. And in particular, the field theory, the string theory that would correspond to a non-supersymmetric gauge theory would be living at the singularity of the spacetime. You would have no description of that side. I mean, there may be, string theory knows what it is, but it's not a useful description because we don't know how to describe it. Okay. So more detail about this isomorphism, this duality between string theory and gauge theory. So this is a picture of ADS space, or its covering space, because we don't want any closed time-like curves. And its boundary is a three-sphere in the space and times time. And as it happens, the dual field theory also lives on S3 cross R. And so what is the relation? Well, there's a sense in which the gauge theory indeed does live on the boundary of the ADS space. And there's also a sense in which it doesn't. One way to ask the question is to consider, as a thought experiment, some kind of wave packet, some kind of localized disturbance, wave packet or gravitons or something, at some point in the interior of the ADS space. And now take advantage of the isometries and imagine following this state under an isometry that moves it towards the infinity in the ADS space. That same isometry, by the way, has the property that as it moves it to infinity in the radial direction, it converges in the other directions. And so, in fact, if you ask, what does the same isometry do just in the gauge theory? So we got isometries in both places, and we have the map from one to the other. Well, it takes some state which might have been a diffuse state, and it dilates it to a point. So the statement is that excitations near the boundary of ADS space correspond to local states in the field theory, states in which the fields are disturbed only at a point. There are various ways to say that. One of the ways I like this was a quote from Sean Carroll that I thought better of and deleted, but is that if you consider the field operators in the bulk, if you consider the field operators like the gravitational field, and consider their limits as they approach the boundary, that the limiting values of those field operators are in fact the local operators of the quantum field theory. It's also said in other ways, which maybe are more useful for calculation, that a perturbation of the boundary conditions, there's some natural set of boundary conditions up here, and a perturbation of the boundary conditions is effectively as a Hamiltonian local operator here. But since I like to think of it as an isomorphism of Hilbert spaces, there should be a corresponding isomorphism of local operators, and here it is. The local operators of the field theory map to the boundary values of the local operators of the bulk. So it's in that sense that the gauge theory lives at the boundary, but it doesn't really live at the boundary because the gauge theory describes the entire Hilbert space of the string theory, gravity of the string and gravity theory in the interior, and you can kind of see what happens if you imagine starting with what we just figured out, that we act with a local operator at some point on the boundary, and ask what happens in the on the two sides of the duality. Well, in the bulk, you'll have some kind of wave that propagates inward till it gets to this chord at some later time. In the boundary theory, you'll have, again, some kind of growing wave, which just sort of, well, it looks like this. Where the chord meets the boundary, that's where the wave is. And those two dots where this growing wave meets the boundary are really in S2 because I've had to suppress so many dimensions. So the statement is that just as a local disturbance on the one side is a disturbance at infinity on the other, a state in the interior is also represented in the boundary theory, but it's represented by some kind of non-local state, some kind of spread out state in which the fields are excited just on a two-sphere. And there's been some investigation, various thought experiments, trying to make this more precise. I think it's the key thing to make this precise, because the real question is now that we do believe that the count of degrees of freedom in here matches with the count of degrees of freedom in the field theory, but what is certainly not manifest and has to be taken from these various circumstantial arguments is that in fact the physics is local in the interior. So that for some reason a state which is localized at some point in the interior here, and therefore in the field theory lives on some specific two-sphere, that a state which is there interacts only with other states at the same point. So there's some kind of locality, there is some kind of locality in the interior which is encoded in the field theory in a very subtle way. One of the things again we know is that the state, this non-local state, can't be characterized entirely by gauge invariant local operators because they again only measure the boundary conditions. You need something like Wilson loops or non-local gauge invariant operators. So anyway, the duality is holographic in the sense that any state which lives on this space-like surface here, any state which lives on this space-like surface here, in fact, is described by some state of the fields on this boundary. And again, with this interesting stipulation that the more localized the boundary state, the further out the interior state, the states way in the interior are described by some kind of very delocalized excitations. Okay, yes? Sean. Wait, I should repeat that, but I have to ask you to repeat it first. Sorry?
I can fill in that boundary.
Yes.
Here, the
difference between yes. Good. Why yes. It's a good question. Right. So here's the system of the boundary at a specific time. And the question is, what is the interior space? How do I fill in the interior geometry? And the answer is, you fill it in an arbitrary way, I think this is in the spirit of the global times that you have in S-type flat spaces, that they tell you how the physics moves forward in time as you move the boundary time forward, independent of the parameterization in the middle. In fact, there's a related question, which is, an event which is, there is an event which is local in the interior, local in time in the interior, local in time on the boundary. I think this is the dictionary isn't clear. But I think, in relativity, you want to think of many-fingered time. And the only thing which is invariant is the statement of where the space-like surface meets the boundary.
So for that one boundary, mm-hmm. here,
yes.
I could put two different space-like
lights. That's right. Right.
Because I would have thought that the state
would be different. Well, one evolves into, that's a good way to think about it, because one evolves, they're the same state seen on two different slices. But you're... Yes. Yeah, from another point of view, the way you get this extra dimension is the fact that the interior fields do satisfy equations of motion. That in some sense this is an interesting question that I can't answer right now. If I whack the theory with a local operator, I make something which moves inward from the boundary. If I whack it with a Wilson loop, which is a non-local operator, I, in fact, don't make something which is in the interior. I make a string which then propagates inward. So that's a good question. Is there any way to whack, although there seems to be this isomorphism of states, is there some operator with which I can whack the boundary theory that instantly makes a given interior state? I don't know.
What do you mean, whack?
Act on the vacuum. Yes. Just as Gary uses kick.
Yeah. I mean, an interior state, of mm-hmm. course, is going to be some ordinary state in the gauge theory.
Mm-hmm.
So you just want to change your state from the ground state to this other.
Right, but now I'm confused because, A, I don't know how to change the state locally. I think this is a question that needs some thought because I don't know how to change the state locally in an invariant way. And the first thing that came to mind, which was a Wilson line, didn't work.
You don't know how to do it.
In the bulk, right.
Are they Wilson lights? Are they Wilson lights
light and space-time in the boundary theory, or are they spatial?
The question is whether the Wilson lines are in space-time or space. You could consider either, because you have the full space-time on the boundary.
Okay, so you're
the, right. My pictures have always been Minkowskiian, and the Wilson lines have been primarily studied in the Euclidean case. Now, this word holographic came up. Okay. This word holographic came up, and there's this old idea from black hole physics that, in fact, physics should have, gravity should have this property full Hilbert space can be characterized entirely by degrees of freedom on the boundary. And remarkably, this duality realizes that, but it's not sort of a complete realization of that. It's a rather weak realization of holography. You can ask, how holographic is this description? Well, you can consider subvolumes and ask, does it still apply? And the answer is, as Susskind and Witten argued, is yes. As you sort of move to smaller subvolumes, then this, you get a field theory with a cutoff so that only the low energy degrees of freedom survive. But there's a limit to this. If you try to remember, this ADS space has a natural size, its curvature radius. And if you try to consider states localized on scales smaller than the curvature radius, and there were questions about small black holes earlier on that are directly connected to this, the statement is that in fact the holographic description breaks down. We do not have a holographic description of this black hole in terms of a boundary smaller than the ADS radius. And so to extend the holographic principle to that, it's like extending it to flat space-time, because this space is locally flat. It's a point which is not completely understood, and maybe we can come back to that. Okay, as I said, the theory is only weakly holographic. An interesting thing is that it's a general property in dualities that one has a gauge symmetry on one side and a gauge symmetry on the other. So both sides of the duality are described in terms of redundant degrees of freedom, but with different redundancies. There is no relation between the gauge group on the one side and on the other, and that's true here. In this case, the gauge group on the ADS side is or includes the diffeomorphisms of the bulk. The objects in the gauge theory are neutral under the diffeomorphisms of the bulk because they live at the boundary. Now, the boundary theory does have a gauge symmetry of its own, the SUN gauge symmetry, but that's kind of a simpler gauge symmetry. It's much easier to write down SUN invariants than it is to write down diffeomorphism invariants. So the comment is that as with other dualities, the point of contact between the two sides is that you look at invariants, simple invariants on both sides. And so for trying to extend this to other spaces, less ADS-like spaces, it seems that one needs to consider invariant quantities. Now, this is the duality I mentioned is just one of many. There's a strange pattern here. All of these spaces on the gravity side are ADS-like or something. The field theories are in some cases known rather explicitly, and in some cases are only inferred. Their existence is only inferred, and a few of their properties are known. So it's a very strange, it's characteristic of these dualities that you get a strange and intricate pattern with no indication of where it came from. That is, what are the degrees of freedom that you start with in this theory that when you put them on these various spaces resolve themselves into these various field theories? Okay, just about done, on time, under budget. That's what we used to say in particle physics before the SSC. as here, it always required creative bookkeeping. But anyway, just a comment which I already sort of made, that in dualities, information flows both ways, because there are things one understands here, there are things one understands here, and most of the calculations have been flowing from gravity to field theory. The information for gravity and string theory is still rather conceptual. And again, it's that this system, which seems to contain in it gravity and seems to contain in it, therefore, black holes, nevertheless has a completely Hamiltonian description. So to conclude, the key issue is to understand how locality in the ADS space emerges from the gauge theory. And this is one of those things which has to do with the fact that the gauge theory has a large number of fields. This really, I think, has to be confronted because it's well known. Well, there's a long history, of course, of field theories with large numbers of fields. Much is understood about them, but not these that we need here. But it is clear that you can sort of hide a lot in a large matrix. And in some sense, the locality of the ADS space is encoded in some subset of the n degrees of freedom, which one has to identify. So I think at some level, one has to really look inside the field theory and understand it better. And then the other big question is, what is the general principle that underlies these various dualities? So thank you.
Maybe to kick it off, can I ask a question directly related to your talk? Can you go back to the transparency with your commuting diagram that started the whole thing?
Yes.
Yeah, just a point of logic that I missed.
I mean,
the duality was motivated by taking the low energy limit.
Right.
So I just don't see why we don't conclude that 3 plus 1 super Yang-Mills theory is dual to not the full supergravity / string theory, et cetera, but just to this, what's on the bottom right of the diagram, namely the near horizon limit, which in some sense I can't specify as a truncation of the full supergravity / string theory.
It is a meaningful truncation. That is, there is, I mean, it, what comes down, well, I think Gary mentioned this, what comes down to practice is you have a metric with a 1 in it, you throw away the 1. Just keep, but, no, there is a meaningful, maybe even a mathematically meaningful sense in which ADS space is a limit of the space that includes the brain. And it's a state, but it's a limit which involves in its statement behaviors, asymptotically low energy behaviors of the spectrum. Now, part of what you said, which I didn't follow, was you thought that there should be less over here than...
Right, because I think there should be... Well, I assume that there's... Just stay on the left-hand side of the diagram.
Right.
I guess I really should ask it that way. Yeah. Are you sort of saying that contained within this is everything up there?
No, because, again, this is the low... I've taken just the extreme asymptotic... It's really, again, the asymptotic limit, but a productive one. I've taken the extreme low energy asymptotics and energy on both sides. So no, I haven't kept. Well, this is what bothered me for 6 months. Over here, I've thrown away the excited strings. I've kept only the ground state strings. Yet over here, I do have excited strings because I can take a string, which is a rather heavy thing, but by moving it close to the horizon, its energy is measured in terms of the killing energy. Its energy is arbitrarily small. So you know, this seemed nuts to me that you throw away the strings and yet they come back. But again, it's not nuts. It's similar again to what happens in many other dualities. That simply a piece of the spectrum, which up here is realized as some kind of fundamental string state, over here is realized as some coherent state of electric field.
I don't want to dominate the discussion. Beverly had a question.
Yeah, I just had a very naive question. Are these 3 plus 1 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theories anything you might pick to study for any other reason? Are they related to unified theories? of particle physics or
the theories which it's a very good question. The theories which are of interest for particle physics have four supersymmetries. This has to do with constraints of phenomenology. The theory with 16 supersymmetries has a very nice mathematical structure, including conformal invariance. In fact, one of my long list of other dualities is that it's known how, given this duality, by changing the boundary in very specific ways, to reduce two dualities with smaller supersymmetries, including the right number for physics. However, the cases where the duality is useful, it's kind of the fact that nature is maximally grubby and isn't going to have a much simpler description because the cases which are interesting have in general less supersymmetry but still are conformally invariant, which of course nature isn't. The standard model, it might be derived from something simpler, but it's not going to have in itself a simpler dual description because it's, again, kind of maximally grubby.
I would like you to comment on the following. Normally we think of energy and ground states and things like that as things that we can define under very special circumstances. So when you're speaking about the meta theory in some sense, about things that are above the theory, how can you use concepts that belong to some particular sectors?
Well, good, that's right. Clearly this discussion and this derivation used concepts that are specific to these boundary conditions where you do have a global energy. And in the asymptotic flat space case, we still have a global energy, but we don't know the duality. Maybe the most interesting case is a closed universe where there isn't any energy. I think the answer is that what we found is still rather special. And we don't know what is sort of the... It's a good question. I mean, we don't have a real guiding principle at this point to find these less special dualities. I mean, in some sense, my attitude as a particle physicist has always been that if I can understand space in a volume about 3 kilometers on a side, which is how big the Slack accelerator is, I would be happy. And certainly for any of these spaces that we've discussed, you can make N, the charge, large enough that the ADS radius is 3 kilometers and you could build a Slack accelerator. So I suppose that at one level, this should make me happy. But in fact, to really recover the local physics, you have to, again, N is very, very large, and there is some idea which is missing to extract the sort of how the degrees of freedom organize themselves, what's the right basis for the degrees of freedom. So even in the cases where leaving aside the cases where we don't have the duality, even in the cases where we do have the duality, it's more of an existence proof than a construction in some sense because we don't have the full dictionary. Yes.
I'm a bit confused about this locality.
Yes.
Various stages.
So this question is about this locality in the inside space time.
Yes.
Because, I mean, you hinted or you explicitly said that somehow the diffeomorphisms, which are asymptotically identity,
yes,
should be thought of as a gauge.
Yes.
If that is the case, that is what we are sort of used to in general relativity in general. Okay. So, and it is well motivated, as you're saying, from the point of view of this, Hamiltonian dynamics or whatever one wants to use. But then if that is the case, then one doesn't really expect too many local observables, right? Because if diffeomorphism inside, I mean, if these diffeomorphisms which are asymptotically identity are going to be gauged,
right,
then
right,
the observables that will come up will have to be invariant under these,
right,
and these will necessarily be sort of very global things. And of course, I mean, one would imagine that if you have the whole, I mean, and we know this in simple theories like 2+1 gravity, which is very simple,
yes,
that in fact one can give oneself global observables, but a complete list of them, so that if
yes,
you give me the values of those global observables, then I can construct a diffeomorphism equivalence class of solutions.
Yes.
But so I don't understand locality. I mean, it seems to me that is inherently very non-local, and that's the way it perhaps should be.
Good. Yes. Well, let me. I'm making the point that since I said we expect only invariants, diffeomorphism invariants, to be realized on the gauge theory side. And since diffeomorphism invariants are in general very non-local, maybe we shouldn't expect to be able to answer local questions. But we have to do better than that, even if only, I think locality in that sense is something which is not going to be fundamental in the sense that the degrees of freedom in which we initially formulate the theory are local. But still, it has to be possible to derive an effective local description, which is something that you could imagine doing, by appropriate gauge fixing. And let me mention a local question which came up in Gary's talk, which relates to this discussion of holographic principle. This picture is supposed to show a black hole smaller than the ADS radius, and therefore one which has a negative specific heat. So what is the gauge theory description of it? Well, what it is a thermal excitation of some subset of the degrees of freedom of the gauge theory. It's not the gauge theory in thermal equilibrium, some subset of degrees of freedom, a subset which is more or less localized in this small region, has been thermally excited, and then if you wait for the black hole to evaporate, that energy has equilibrated, and the system is in a full thermal equilibrium state, which in this case is a state of Hawking radiation. So there's a question where there's a physical locality that we're missing. How do you see that the gauge theory has some subset degrees of freedom which can thermalize with each other and yet only much more slowly thermalize with the rest of the system?
But that configuration is physically exactly the same as one in which that little ball was diffeomorphed.
This is diffeomorphism because it's putting it here. Well, actually, that would be a diffeomorphism to the extent that the space is sort of ADS except for that disturbance, it would have to be a diffeomorphism that moved the boundary. So it's actually not. I mean, I can enumerate all the places I could put a black hole, and in each of those places there have to be a set of degrees of freedom I can excite.
Okay.
It's a different set.
Yeah, it's exactly ADS. Yeah.
Steve's been waiting.
Is there any fundamental reason, any fundamental way of understanding why n should be large for the real universe? In the string theory description, you started with n as just being some measure of a particular flux. Mm-hmm. Is it just an empirical observation that for our universe n must be large for this description to make sense?
The question is, why is n large in our universe? And, well, I don't know that n is large in our universe because we presumably don't live in a universe like in the pseudo space. We live in a universe with a more interesting cosmology, which may have some completely other description. I mean, I find it very hard to imagine how a closed universe could start small, where you would say n would be small, and end up very large. I mean, where do all those states come from? And so I think for cosmological spaces, the issues won't be so simply phrased. Now, you can ask, what happens if n is 2? Well, then the ADS space is very small, smaller than a string. Then the gauge theory is simpler. If n is 2 and g is small, we know what the gauge theory is. And the gauge theory is now the answer to a very interesting question. What does string theory look like on an ADS space smaller than the Planck scale? Well, that's, the gauge theory is the answer, but what do you do with it? I mean, it's not a question that you ever would have thought to ask. And you can ask, well, why don't we live there? And, well, if no other reason for the entropic principle, because there isn't enough real estate. Maybe there's a better reason. There aren't enough black holes, if you ask Lee.
So I think I've got a related question here. Could you start by putting back up your stage 2 string duality slide?
Yes.
Okay. So
my favorite.
Your favorite, good. So at least I heard a number of talks that show this picture. And at least back in the stage 2 days, people used to express at least the hope that all the different string vacua, all parts of string theory were connected, and there was some dynamical principle that could evolve you from one to the other. So is that same sort of hope still here with all these different ADS-type conjectures, that there might even be some dynamical linking between these different field theories which correspond to different ADS spaces, and that somehow even these different field theories could contain each other and be connected? Is that part of the hope, expectation, belief?
I think, well, when that hope was expressed, it was in the context of, I think, spaces where you have a Minkowski space and a compact space, and that the compact space could explore all of its, you know, all possible compact spaces.
The better principle. The hope has to be wider, right? If you want to say, why are we not stuck in some isolated part of string theory,
spaces with asymptotically ADS boundary conditions are rather rigid. You know, by the nature of their geometry, and it's simply not clear that they, you know, it's not clear that there's any route by which they can tunnel or evolve to states with other kinds of boundary topologies. So, in fact, if they could. It's an open question. Certainly, the direction has always gone that, obviously, you don't break connections, you find them. And the direction has always gone that you found more ways to connect theories. But again, this is a theory with a really special rigidity, so I don't know.
No, I just wanted you to make a connection between the discussion you were having with Abbe and small black holes and the question that Sean asked. Sean said, if I pick a boundary slice, how do I fill it in? And so you could imagine here picking a space-like surface which captures a small black hole.
Right.
Alternatively, you could pick a slice that only has Hawking radiation that's relatively dispersed.
Right.
And you said that the gauge theory doesn't know the difference between those two, yet somehow that didn't seem to be what was coming out in the other discussion.
Good. And this actually does tie in with the question you had in mind. This does tie in with something that Abbe said, because there may be no nice diffeomorphism invariant way for me to distinguish this slice from the later slice in which that is Hawking radiation. But again, the locality is something which is going to emerge not as a property of the fundamental degrees of freedom, but something which emerges in an effective description near certain states. In particular, near this state, this is a rather special state because it looks not just asymptotically like ADS5, it looks everywhere like ADS5 except for a local disturbance. And so there's kind of a natural privilege slicing, I'm not reluctant to use that privilege slicing because I'm not trying to describe the fundamental degrees of freedom here, I'm trying to describe the effective low energy description that emerges.
I just want to make sure I understand the conjecture correctly. So you're saying that if I have two space times that have the same asymptotic behavior, even if they're very different in the inside, string theory of these two things should be equivalent.
No, what I said...
They are equivalent to the gauge theory on the boundary.
Well, I'm sorry. They live in the same Hilbert... Right, sorry. Right, they live in the same... This. Yeah, they're different states in the Hilbert space of the gauge theory. The question had to do with states which looked different instantaneously. There was another question which had to do with states which looked different instantaneously, but in fact were different space-like slices through a single evolving state.
I imagine something that has very different interior.
The statement is, and there seem again to be the right count of states on both sides, that any state with asymptotic behavior is some state in the gauge theory.
I guess I'll just want to make a brief comment. There was someone just said, well, if you take a surface through the black hole, it could be diffeomorphic to a surface later through the Hawking radiation. Mm-hmm. well, that's not a diffeomorphism, right? I mean, if you take a surface through the black hole and you apply diffeomorphism, you still have a surface through the black hole.
That's the wrong choice of words, isn't it?
But you're not going to sort of...
Right, but the...
Diffeomorphisms don't change physics, so you're not going to... that's not really the right...
That's the wrong word, but the right spirit. I mean, right, that was the spirit of the question. That there are different space-like slices with this... There are different space-like slices with the same boundary... different space-like slices with the same boundary limits, and therefore which seem to be described by the gauge theory in the same way, but whose interior description is very different.
Right, but I guess as a diagram that I mean, I showed the Penrose diagram, yeah, in which it was clear that after a while there certainly is not going to be a space-like surface which will go back through the black hole.
Right. You say that's always true, isn't it? Then of course it is. Right. There's not enough room in ADS space. So you say eventually there is, regardless of any confusion we have in the interim. Right. Yeah. Eventually it resolves itself. But
can we restate that with a more explicit word? I'm not sure what the resolution was.
Why did you go and draw the picture again?
Okay.
We need some lights on the board, I think.
Well, you want to get
right there?
Yeah.
either way, it doesn't matter. So what I was saying was just that if you take
So this is a statement of fact, but what is the implication for the correspondence? David is saying that if the relation between the state on the boundary and the state in the interior is sufficiently delocalized in time, then the issue doesn't arise.
So one of the questions I've been wondering is, one of the issues that's sort of unresolved for string theory, if it describes the real world as not only flat spacetime, is the issue about supersymmetry breaking. And even though this context we've talked about here is something different, boundary conditions, it's ADS space, et cetera, one could presumably still ask the same sort of questions there. I was just wondering, does this reformulation in terms of field theory lead to any new insights or difficulties one way or the other with the idea of, you know, how supersymmetry gets broken?
The only idea that comes to mind is work by Cockerew and Silverstein, who sort of took some inspiration from ADS, from this duality, to look for models in which ordinary string type models with broken supersymmetry but with special properties that would make the cosmological constant vanish. But that's kind of stuck. It's not clear.
I guess the basic question is if you look at a 3 plus 1 super Yang-Mills theory,
yes,
is it easy or is it hard to break supersymmetry?
Ah, well, it's easy if you start with just 4 rather than 16. It's easy. There's a strong tendency for the theories to break the supersymmetry. At least, well, there are large regions where they break it. But I'm not sure whether breaking on the one side like that is going to map into breaking in the bulk. It's not clear. It's I wish I had something good to say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There you go.
I'm sorry, but I do want to just go back to this question about the slicing, because
yes.
What David said, or what he was translated to say, was seemed to be different than what was being said before. It seems to me that it is either true that the relationship between the states in the boundary and the states in the bulk is delocalized in time, in which case the problem is not that severe one, or it is strictly local in time, and there has to be a way, given a state on the boundary, that we can decode it to a state in the bulk in which we have a choice, that we can describe a certain thing as a space-like slice through the black hole before it has finished evaporating, or we can decode it to a different space-like slice that includes the Hawking radiation after the black hole has evaporated. Do we know which one of those two cases is the correct one?
Evidently not.
In the conservative case, if you're trying to talk about ADS background linearized fluctuations coming from metrics and other matter fields, then in that case, the Hilbert space is based on those linearized fluctuations at one moment in time, the usual conversation you construct, does map up one point in the state of the game at one moment in time.
Right, but
you don't need to smear out time.
Right, but I guess there's a question, can an event in the interior be identified with an event on the boundary, or is the event somehow really spread out through probably an entire de Sitter time, entire time equals pi that it would take a signal to cross the de Sitter space. And it might very well be that it can't be, that
it could very well be the length of it. Just take it to the interior, take it to zero, it hits the boundary.
I must say that after all the explanations, I am more and more confused. Isn't there a time on the boundary as well as the time inside? Because the field theoretical picture is also a picture of a field which evolves. And therefore, you are somehow talking as if you have the time inside that you do not have the time at the boundary, but that's not true. So right, so it seems to me it's just the usual problem of trying in an asymptotically, forget the string theoretical underpinning of all of this and the duality, then are we not back at the old question in general relativity, where we have a space-time and we have a dynamics in the interior of that space-time, and we would somehow like to reduce the dynamics at what we observe at infinity, and if we have two slices which are asymptotically approaching the same boundary, we cannot reconstruct that internal dynamics from what there is at infinity. So is it not the same problem rehearsed all over again? And what is the answer to it in this context? Namely, did you progress by introducing the duality and the mapping just answering that simple question in ordinary general relativity?
You take that one, David.
But in some sense, you don't need to answer anything but physical questions, and luckily the duality restricts itself to physical observables on both sides. Gauge theory is the you only have on shell matching of the bulk theory with off shell matching of the boundary theory or of the gauge theory. Of course, in gauge theories, you're allowed to ask off shell questions since you could imagine applying other operators. So in both cases, you only are asking physical questions of the theory. And you're trying to, the trouble, I mean, I think that some of the issues are, yeah, the conceptual issues of quantum gravity are not usually formulated in a way that only, this, in terms of physical observables. If you could formulate the problems of, I mean, one step would be to try to reproduce, if you want, the gauge fixed version of the bulk theory from physical observables. That's obviously very difficult to do, having only the gauge invariant correspondence. The other possibility would be to try to erase some of these paradoxes in a more invariant fashion.
Carol, you
have yes. But do you or don't you ultimately want to answer the question, what happens in the quantum theory dynamically in the bulk? How do the things evolve in the bulk? And if that is one of the questions, then how do you translate it into the question at the boundary?
I would say yes, we definitely want to answer this question, and no, we do not yet have the right dictionaries to do it. So I agree with you. These questions that you and other people have worried about certainly come up here. It's not a magic, you know, fix. And we hope that by exploring this sort of duality in more detail, we'll see a resolution. The gauge theory seems unambiguous. We can specify the state, we can Hamiltonian evolve it. We have an evolution on the boundary. And now how we extract from it the physics of the bulk is something we are, you know, trying to sort out. And in that translation will have to be all the usual, you know, problems about how you slice space times and
maybe I should rather
say
next to Gary.
Give up my mic, we only got
it. Yes. But do you have any qualitative idea how the duality would help you? Just some groping about how it could help you in answering the question, which relativity without the duality was not able to answer.
Maybe it wasn't supposed to answer it. I think that's David's point, that the duality gives answers to physical questions. That's a question which in some sense, which is partly a question, well, which you have to go through some amount of gauge fixing and things to set up that question. I mean, you could probably formulate it as a physical question, but it would require something rather complicated.
I give up.
Maybe that's a lunchtime conversation.
Professor
Upton
is
up there.
So now many years have passed since this stage two, and can we remove now what was sort of hopes and conjectures and just say what has been actually shown about in that picture?
Let's see. Well, that picture looks about like it was 4 years ago, except as I mentioned, I added some red to it. The arguments that were, you know, laid out by Hull, Townsend, and Witten in early 95 are still the basic arguments. We don't have more. I mean, what was largely done initially, this is a slice through states of rather high symmetry, and what was largely done initially was to reduce that to states of less symmetry, where it still works but requires fancy mathematics to fill out the picture. It all seems to work. You know, the next direction was to study black holes. So there's not much more one can do with this without, you know, without an idea. And the idea is
So
when one says that in fact all these string theories are the same or something,
yes.
It really is based on this this finite dimensional or perhaps finite dimensional slices through the Hilbert spaces. Is that
well,
right?
Well, a pair.
I think the simplest answer is that there's no conceivable way of proving anything here, because one doesn't have the general framework. One doesn't have a theory of which these are all limiting cases, presumably of a single something, and then you'd have a way of proving it. So we're really, I mean, you would like to, I mean, I think what you're asking was, is anything proved? Is it gone beyond conjecture? And before you have the theory, you obviously can't have a proof.
Wiles says, well, even when we do have the theory, for example, in some of the gauge theory dualities, we don't have a proof. So, you know, there's lots of things that need to, well, it's always true in physics that we understand much more than we can prove. Although this seems like something which might be amenable to proof because it's such, but to the gauge theory, no? You think that?
Maybe we have a theory because, as you're saying, you try to move away.
You're obviously considering more than we normally mean by a quantum field theory, which consists of, you know, Hilbert space with well-defined operators. And there clearly one can conceive in quantum field theory of all sorts of operators that knock you out of Hilbert space normally.
Okay.
And those obviously correspond to things you can do in the mm-hmm. dual side. And they don't fit into the mm-hmm. known framework of quantum field theories. And so I think even in the eventually we'll understand that we're looking at something which is bigger and which a portion of it looks like quantum field theory, and there's sort of perturbations that sort of knock us out of quantum field theory, if you want.
Can I slip in a question now that's directly related to that, which was one of the things you mentioned at the beginning as a prior success of string theory was being able to describe some types of topology change, which I guess you're referring to consequences of mirror symmetry as an example.
Right.
And I'm wondering if that has any realization in the ADS-CFT correspondence. Is there any way to view those topology change processes within this field theory, string theory duality?
That's a good question. The spaces which have topology change, well, the mirror symmetry, those spaces are too complicated and don't yet, I think, have any ADS-CFT realization. One of the simplest things is just T-duality, which actually does have a nice realization in terms of ADS-CFT. In one context, T-duality of the string theory is the S-duality, the weak-strong duality of the gauge theory. Now, that turns something which is relatively simple into something harder, and it hasn't explained it any better, and in some sense it won't for a while because the picture is less local. I mean, the picture is not very local.
Mm-hmm. I think Daniel's.
For a while, people were saying that it was necessary to formulate something called string field theory. So could you remind us what were the problems of this formulation, and does the equivalence or the new definition in terms of gauge fields remove that need?
One way to measure that is by what it's accomplished, and as far as you know, all that string field theory has done is to provide a very complicated way of rewriting the perturbation theory. Now, that might simply mean we haven't figured out how to use it, but again, there are indications. One of this, for example, in some of these contexts, there's a stringy exclusion principle. You can't put more than n strings into one state. In a field theory, you can act with a raising operator any number of times. So there seems to be a real sense in which string field theory might be wrong. It's in some sense strings are bound states of the right thing, and trying to take these bound states and write a field theory that creates and destroys bound states isn't the correct bookkeeping of the states as a theory. And there's no real indication that string field theory is well defined beyond perturbation theory.
Why was it needed?
Because it was thought that, because quantum field theory is well defined beyond perturbation theory, and so the first thing you do is you try what worked in the past. It had small bits of beauty to it, but it.
Yeah. I think that there's things like Umbro effects describing that in string theory.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Would you have to go to some scheme like that?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I mean, you could actually, that might be a case where you could try out string field theory and use it, but. You know, part of the problem is our current formulations of string theory are clumsy, and we always knew they were clumsy, and there's, you know, what we really do secretly a lot of the time is to say, okay, this is a low-energy problem, so we'll use quantum field theory. And to try to, say, calculate under-radiation in a region where the acceleration were stringy, I don't know if it can, can that be done, Gary?
What can be done is just the fact that you can reproduce or reduce string theory to.
You can certainly recover ordinary semi-classical, methods from string theory. You have the classical equations and quantum fields on it. I think it's only like a one-loop effect or something to see. So I think one can certainly get it out of ordinary perturbative string theory.
Let's just take two more brief questions before we break.
Yeah, this is very brief. If you do not have the field string theory, which I can imagine what are the variables in that theory, what is it that you try to have instead? What do you guess that there is in the interior of that space as the proper description of the degrees of freedom? What are the fundamental objects that you are looking after?
After sort of stage two, I think people kind of scratched their heads and didn't know. And now that we have these partial constructions, it seems as though, in one sense, it seems as though things connected with the D-brains, but specifically, you're asking me to guess what the answer is, and I'm not very good at guessing. I can only point to what we do know, which is that, again, in these special contexts, the degrees of freedom really are field theories with large numbers of degrees of freedom. Or small numbers? And humane thing. I don't have a better answer. Once at a strings meeting, I embarrassed myself by saying something about twisters, but it was only because I didn't know what they were. and I still don't know what they are, but I've at least tried to find out, and so I wouldn't say that anymore.
Well, maybe it's time to break for a well-earned lunch. Thank Joe again.